called Wailers for two gone culture workers, Larry Neal and Bob Marley. Wailers. Wailers are we. We are whales. Don't get scared. Nothing happening but out and way out. Nothing happening but the positive, unless you the negative. Whalers, we whalers, yeah, whalers. We whale, we whale.
That's from the poem Whalers by Amiri Baraka, a central figure in the black arts movement. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
When most people hear the phrase black power, they may picture a raised fist. What does the term mean? And how is black power related to the tremendous outpouring of black music and literature known as the black arts movement of the 1960s and early 70s? How did it correspond to the civil rights movement and efforts toward independence in other countries? Joining us to explore black power and the black arts movement is Craig Werner, chair of the Afro-American Studies Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of many books, including A Change is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America, and also of Higher Ground, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, Curtis Mayfield, and the Rise and Fall of American Soul.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Glad to be here.
Always illuminating to spend an hour with you. Black power, capital B, capital P, phenomenon of the 60s and years following. How do you define it? How do you trace it?
Well, most people, when they think of black power, would date it to the mid-1960s, but it really goes back to almost as long as there have been black people on the continent. We start looking at the elements of black power that define it: armed self-defense, assertive black pride, demand for self-determination. Every one of those things is present in the thought of African-American freedom fighters into the pre-slavery period. There was the Black Brotherhood of the late 19th century, the Marcus Garvey movement of the 1920s, the assertiveness of black veterans returning from World War II. But for all of that, there was definitely something different about the black power movement of the 1960s. And I think, as we heard from Amiri Baraka, it has to do with style, self-consciousness, and openness of expression that really had changed.
Well, let's talk about Amiri Baraka changing his name from Leroy Jones. To what extent was this a growing consciousness of African roots?
Very much so. That Amiri Baraka was born Leroy Jones. He had established himself as a poet, a member of the Beat Generation, really, a friend of Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, Jack Kerouac, someone who was very much part of the interracial bohemia of the 1950s. And then in the early 1960s, he underwent a change of consciousness. You can hear it and see it in his searing play, Dutchman, one of the greatest pieces of American theater. And shortly thereafter, he changed his name to Amamu Amiri Baraka first, moved from downtown to Harlem and Newark, where he was born, divorced his white wife, and started a new life, started over. And it was very much part of a change of consciousness. You saw it everywhere. The most famous change of name and change of consciousness, of course, would be Malcolm X, also known as Malcolm Little, later known as Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, and basketball players. Orrin Armstrong became Warren Jabali. Again and again, people were claiming a new name, the right to name oneself and name oneself publicly.
Now, a lot of those names, though, were Islamic. What's the tie there?
They were Islamic and they were Swahili. That there was a disagreement at the time about where to go with that. And also, one of the most common gestures was simply Malcolm's, to say, we don't know our real names. Those names had been taken from us by the history of oppression by slavery. And so claiming one's X was getting rid of the slave owner's name. There was an interest in Islam, the Nation of Islam. Malcolm said that Christianity was a white man's religion, that Islam was the true black man's religion. But there were many, many proponents of the Black Arts Movement who believed that what they were really doing was getting deeper into a African-American heritage that couldn't be reduced to Islam. They knew that Islam was a slave owning religion as much as Christianity was. And so there was a wide range of types of approaches people took to changing their names.
So you could be, say, a fundamentalist Christian black of some kind and still be involved in black power?
I'm not sure the fundamentalist has the same meaning in that context as it does in our world today, but certainly one could be a committed Christian. James Cone, theologian, wrote a book called Black Theology and Black Power, later a book called God of the Oppressed. And he became a central figure not only in American theology, but in the liberation theology that spread to Latin America. And a very, very powerful Christian black power presence. You hear it in the poem that we heard from Amiri Baraka, which he names Larry Neal, a wonderful literary critic, and Bob Marley, famous reggae musician. And Bob Marley was very much fundamentalist in some ways, if you want to put it like that. He traced his vision of the world to biblical texts, to scriptural texts, the Rastafarian yes. visit, profoundly religious. Black Arts Movement was also split on that. Some of the proponents of it were intensely secular. They were Marxists. They believed that religion was an opiate of the people. Some were deeply committed. And I think that points to one of the major themes of the Black Power movement, which is that there was no simple center there. It was many different things that shared some basic beliefs.
And where do the Black Panthers fit into the Black Power movement? We think of them sort of synonymously, but
and what were the various organizations involved in it?
The Black Panthers, again, were actually two different things. The people think of the Black Panthers, they usually think of the California group. They think of the Black Panthers of Huey Newton, of Eldridge Cleaver, which was a group which originated in the Bay Area fundamentally as a resistance to police brutality. That what the Panthers originally called themselves was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And what they would do is they would listen to the police radio and go out and simply observe arrests to try to cut down on police brutality. They passed out cards which informed members of exactly what their rights were, how far away they needed to stay from the arrest scene, what they needed to do with their weapons to avoid concealed weapons charges. And they were addressing a specifically urban, and I would say in some ways specifically Western, set of issues. But they had taken their inspiration from a Southern organization connected more with Stokely Carmichael, was the best known figure of that, in Lowndes County, where there had been a long civil rights movement, and the Panthers were a younger set of Southern freedom fighters who basically rejected the gradualism, the strategies of the older generation, and the first appearance of the Black Panther as symbol is actually in the South, not in California.
And is there the sort of a sound that we can listen to from the Black Panthers that gives us a sense of that voice?
Yeah. I think that what we could do is we can listen to the leader of them, Huey Newton, and this is cut by Huey Newton in which he calls for power to the people.
So I would like to say that we're one tonight. Let us be one in the future. Power to all of the people.
Well, there's nothing too radical about that if you just listen to the words. I mean, it could have been any number of presidential candidates.
I don't think Richard Nixon would have agreed. Ronald Reagan certainly wouldn't have agreed. He was governor in California when the Panthers emerged as a public force, and he made a great deal of political capital attacking the Panthers. They were viewed as being tremendously radical. The issue, of course, involves what we mean by power.
And how you get it.
And how you get it. And the Black Panthers certainly were attacking the entrenched forms of power. The question was, and I think you hear this in that cut by Huey, power to the people. call for unity, the response he gets from the crowd. There's an emotional high to that. But there then becomes the question of just exactly what kind of power are we trying to get and how do we go about trying to get it? And that was where the Black Power movement spent as much time arguing amongst itself as it did confronting.
Well, let me see if I can give a contrast here. Is that the sort of thing that Martin Luther King would have said, power to the people?
Well, Martin Luther King wouldn't have said it that way, but Martin Luther King ultimately would say that he was looking for power in a more serious way. One of the key moments in the development of Black Power was on the March Against Fear following the attack on civil rights leader James Meredith, who had been marching in Mississippi and was shot by the side of the road. And a number of civil rights organizations came together to keep that march going. And it was during that march that Stokely Carmichael really emerged as a public figure through attacking King, through attacking the entrenched civil rights movement. One of the kind of touchstone ways of talking about the shift from civil rights to Black Power is the slogans that were chanted on that march, that the civil rights leaders were chanting, "Freedom now, freedom now." And the response from the young militants was Black Power, to which King responded that power had always been at the center of the agendas of ethnic groups in the United States, that the Irish wanted power, the Jews wanted power. And he wasn't being anti-Semitic when he said that. He was simply talking about ethnic politics. But he commented somewhat sardonically on the Black Power movement. He says that what happened was that the Irish got the power and the blacks just got the slogan. And so King, as he looked at the Black Power movement, said that it really, on a certain level, wasn't engaged with the actual issues that were involved with getting power, that power flows through the political system in part because the political system is how you get control of the rules that control the economic.
What's the role of violence in this whole Black Power movement or the espousal of violence?
Well, violence was obviously a touchstone issue. It was where the mainstream politicians attacked the Black Power movement. They said that this is about violence, that this is about revolution in some ways. And the Black Power movement asked for that in its rhetorical espousal of violence. But there are a couple of things I think that are worth thinking about, one of which many Black Power leaders said. They said, "I don't want the people fighting the war in Vietnam and selling arms around the world to tell us to be nonviolent." We're talking about a culture in which John Wayne is the central symbol during the 1960s. Look at any 10 minutes on the TV set and tell me that America is about nonviolence. It was phrased more as armed self-defense was the key issue of that. And for all that Martin Luther King was associated with nonviolence, the fact is Martin Luther King had guns in the house, that Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth in Birmingham, where he was the police force, visited huge terrorist violence upon the movement. He had a bodyguard who was armed at all times. Otherwise, he would have been killed. So violence was present partially as image. What the Black Power movement said is, we're not going to pretend. We're just going to have those guns there because this is America, folks, and guns are at the center of it. But it is also true that the willingness of the Panthers to associate themselves with violence was part of what made them vulnerable to attack. They lost the rhetorical high ground. They lost the moral high ground that the civil rights movement had worked very, very carefully to establish. And so violence was, to some extent, a reality, that there was a thuggish element that got itself associated with the Black Power movement, that the civil rights movement, to use that distinction, wouldn't have accepted.
Well, in Malcolm X's speech, the Ballads to Bullets one, where he talks about stop singing and start swinging, there's also an acknowledgement in Malcolm X's speech, or a claim, I guess you could say, that because of Black Power, the civil rights movement gained more acceptance as a kind of alternative.
Yeah, and Malcolm was certainly very conscious of that, that he knew that if he presented an image of threat, if you don't straighten up your act now, then you're going to have fire in the streets. James Baldwin said the same thing. God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time. And he wrote that essay in late 1962, right before the beginning of the riots in the American cities. But there was very much this sense that, okay, America, white America, you have your last chance. Are you going to take it, or are you going to drop the ball again, at which point there will be chaos in the streets? And there was chaos in the streets.
If we talk about, yes, 1962, we don't think of that as being a particularly turmoil-ridden year. But by 1963, 64, we do. So what were the things that made things coalesce so quickly?
Baldwin says very, very clearly that it wasn't coalescing quickly, that it had been building for a long time. And that because Martin Luther King had done such a brilliant job of presenting a morality play on television in the United States, and that Lyndon Johnson, as tribute to John Kennedy, would get the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act passed, that didn't change the fact that for ordinary black people, things were not changing very quickly, that the conditions on the streets, particularly black power, emphasized, focused on the North and the West, the urban settings increasingly. And in those settings, the issues at hand were issues of housing segregation. They were issues of employment. They were issues of police brutality. It wasn't a matter of getting a law passed. The legal situation for black folks in the North was more or less similar to what it was for white folks. The day-by-day reality was hugely different, and that's what Baldwin said, and that's what Malcolm was saying was going to lead to the explosion.
What are some of the other sounds besides that Power to the People by Huey Newton? What are some of the other sounds that you link to this political sort of undergirding of the Black Power movement?
Well, I think it's impossible to separate the politics from the music in the Black Power era. Dick Gregory, the African-American stand-up comic who became a political activist, ran for president in 1968. Dick Gregory said that Aretha Franklin was as important a political leader as Martin Luther King. He said, you heard Dr. King on the radio once a day. You heard Aretha every hour. James Brown, I mean, I think the song Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud is as much a summation of the Black Power movement as anything you could imagine.
The role of the Black Power movement and sports. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air.
Sign up for Wisconsin Public Radio's monthly e-newsletter to find out about all things WPR. You'll get in-depth information on programs, news, and upcoming events. Go to WPR.org to sign up today.
Today it's time to stop singing and start swinging. And I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know it, that you got a new generation of black people in this country who don't care anything whatsoever about Oz. They don't want to hear you old Uncle Tom handkerchief heads talking about the Oz. No. This is a new generation.
That's from a speech by Malcolm X. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Craig Werner, and we're talking about black power and the black arts movement. One of the kind of visual symbols that we have for the black power movement is those raised fists at the Olympics. Can you talk about that and also about black power in sports?
The 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, the African-American sprinters for the United States dominated. And on the podium where they were receiving their medals, John Smith, Tommy Carlos, refused to raise their heads for the national anthem. They raised their fists, they had black gloves on, looked down at the ground as a symbol of protest about being asked to serve as symbols of the United States. We had used for many years our athletes as a goodwill ambassadors, a role which they had accepted with some uneasiness. Got people like Willie Mays and Ernie Banks, baseball players who embraced the role. You had somebody like Jackie Robinson, who was much more ambivalent about it, although he was a mainstream civil rights kind of a supporter. And then in the 1960s, a new breed, those who were swinging, fighting, rather than entertaining, singing, stepped to the forefront, and nobody was more central to that than Muhammad Ali.
Who resisted the draft in a protest against the power structure in America?
Yeah, Muhammad Ali had grown up in Louisville, a poor
Cassius Clay,
named after a slaveholding senator. And shortly after he won the heavyweight championship from Sonny Liston in what was viewed as an amazing upset at the time. Nobody expected Clay, as he was known at the time, to win that fight. He announced that he was a member of the Nation of Islam. He was seen in public with his mentor, Malcolm X. Malcolm was very close to him. Muhammad was also very close to Sam Cooke. There was that connection between singing and swinging there. And that image of Muhammad Ali asserting himself as a black pride symbol, standing up against the war in Vietnam, saying no Viet Cong ever did anything to me, that it became just a fiery presence at the center. And that connection with Sam Cooke, with Malcolm X, with Muhammad Ali kind of gives you the image that black power was partially about politics, but it also, and I think more importantly in the long run, just absolutely changed the image and the presence of African Americans in American society. It's not like Michael Jordan is a black power guy, but Michael Jordan is not possible without black power.
What were the repercussions for Muhammad Ali and for the Olympians who raised their fists?
Huge, that they were punished for it. And Lee Evans, the third of the sprinters on the podium that day, stood at attention and did not join in the protest, and he was punished the same as the others were. And Ali was, his career was taken away from him. Ali probably is the greatest boxer of the 20th century, maybe of all time, in the heavyweight division anyway. But it's amazing to think what he accomplished, having had several years at the absolute peak of his career taken away from him. They wouldn't let him box, and they ran him out, and he came back and reestablished himself as a fighter. And I mean, it's amazing that Muhammad Ali has become a idol and emblem of the United States, that he lights the Olympic torch.
Yes, I know. It's sort of a full circle there, isn't it?
Yeah. Nobody would have thought that was possible.
And how did it happen? In other words, the process of turning Cassius Clay into Muhammad Ali, is it that he had read the autobiography of Malcolm X? Is it that he had encountered the Black Panthers?
He heard what he recognized as a truth from Malcolm X. And that was always Malcolm's primary strength. And in some ways it remains the primary strength of the Nation of Islam, is that for large parts of particularly the poor African-American community, what they hear from politicians, what they hear on the radio, certainly what they were hearing then from Richard Nixon, from Hubert Humphrey, ran for president, from Lyndon Johnson, particularly about Vietnam, they simply looked at it and said, this is lies. This is lies. We've been lied to so long that there is nobody out here who we believe will tell us the truth. And Malcolm simply sat down and he spoke truth. Now, whether that's a political agenda, I don't know. I don't know how it changes power, but it certainly got a huge response from people like the then Cassius Clay. He heard Malcolm describing the world that he lived in. He responded to it. He knew that there were many things wrong in the community he was living in, that families were in trouble, that alcoholism, that drug abuse. One of the things that the Nation of Islam offered was a moral agenda. It was a way of straightening out a mess that the welfare system and the educational system were making worse rather than better. So it was about, again, those basic Black Power virtues of self-respect and self-determination.
How did Black Power manifest itself in other professional sports, baseball and football, which are notorious money machines and sectors of the status quo?
And in which it's a lot harder to make an individual stand. It was everywhere. It was there in style, in the style of play. Probably the place you saw that most clearly was in basketball, always a sport with a large black presence in it. But during the Black Power era, I love the old American Basketball Association. They played with the orange and blue basketball. It's where Dr. J, Julius Erving, David Thompson, the Skywalker emerged as figures. And they had weird uniforms, colorful uniforms. They let guys wear afros, and it's where the dunk started to happen. It's where a kind of basketball as style and self-assertion, as opposed to just winning on the scoreboard, came in to play. So in basketball, you could see it. Baseball, you saw it in some of the great teams of that era. You saw it in the Oakland Athletics with Reggie Jackson. You saw it in the Pittsburgh Pirates, who put an all-black team on the field for the first time, won world championships. Somebody like Roberto Clemente, usually not thought of as a black power guy, was a very assertive, very politically aware Latin black man who was talking about the diaspora in those terms and was doing activist work in poor communities back home in Puerto Rico, building those things, that some teams responded to it. You needed a manager who was smart enough to let it go, let guys play music in the locker room, the Pirates locker room, absolutely rocked. I mean, they became a disco thing later on. Football was slowest to adjust.
Hard to make a statement with that uniform on, for one thing.
Yeah,
There were people
who did it. Dallas Cowboys had a running back named Dwayne Thomas who was very open about the fact that he liked to smoke marijuana and that he would follow team rules when and if he felt like following team rules. And the Cowboys coach, Tom Landry, could not have been any more conservative Republican if he'd been Spiro Agnew. And what happened there is they got rid of Dwayne Thomas. But Landry stuck around, and Dwayne Thomas didn't. And football was very, very slow to change.
You start seeing some of those dreadlocks and things, and the afros, I suppose, before that.
Yeah,
once the helmets came off.
Yeah, less in football than on other sports. Again, it's more bureaucratic. It's more the metaphors of football or the metaphors of Vietnam. You know, we're going to do containment. We're going to attack. We've got the aerial assaults going on. And so there was more tension within football, but everywhere where there were black players, there was a black political presence.
And if we look at black power and the black arts movement, is there a center in this country, or does it mean different things depending on whether you're in the South or in Chicago or in California?
There were attempts to establish a center. One of the theorists of the movement was a guy whose birth name is Ron Karanga, who changed his name to Mawalana Karanga, associated with the cultural wing of the Black Power movement in California. And Karanga attempted to set a set of values that would draw the Southern, the Northern, the Western movements together. One of the slogans that you hear sometimes is unity without uniformity, that we want to all be together, but we don't want to all be the same. Easier said than done. But Karanga said that what black power was about, and he was speaking specifically here in terms of the art, the black arts movement, the cultural wing of the black power movement. He said that what black art does is it must expose the enemy, praise the people, and support the revolution. Now, each one of those terms can be heard in dozens of different ways. Who was the enemy? For the Nation of Islam, the enemy was white devils, literally, that white people had been bred by an evil genius scientist to torment black folks. For Huey Newton, the enemy was international capitalism. For people who were associated with the more Afrocentric, as we would call them, groups, the enemy was to be found in the deep premises of Western culture. The Black Arts Movement was involved with deconstructing Western civilization before anybody in English departments in the United States had heard the term, deconstruction. But the enemy could be anywhere. And Haki Madhubuti, his original name, Don Lee, back to the name change form, poet out of Chicago, wrote a poem in which he said, and I apologize for the language in advance, but it's key on the movement. He said, "Must I shoot the white man dead to kill the nigger in my head?" Said that what this was about was overthrowing the white presence in black life, however that articulated itself, so that one was no longer a thing, what the N-word signifies, that one could become a black man. And this was the point at which the terminology changed from Negro to black. One of the things people didn't like about Muhammad Ali is he refused to be called a Negro. So that's a white man's word. That's a white man's creation. I'm not going to do that. And so there were transformations all over. Who is the enemy? Then praising the people. This was the time of black pride. Black is beautiful. Curtis Mayfield, a wonderful songwriter, wrote a song called "I'm So Proud." You know, "I'm so proud to be with you." And people didn't generally, white listeners didn't hear it as a black power song. Black listeners sure did. It was about self-acceptance. And then the key element is support the revolution. Well, what does that mean?
Yes.
Are we taking it to the streets? Are we taking over Congress by voting? What do we need to do to really institute fundamental change?
Well, the trick being that they were, after all, then a minority. And so, I mean, how in terms of votes could you take over Congress without some kind of partnering?
Well, the attacks were multiple on that. The Congress of African Peoples, in which Amiri Baraka played a major part, was committed in part to taking over city governments, the mayor's offices, in cities in which there were black majorities, and to understanding that in many states, black people had the swing votes on it. Malcolm was interesting in the way he looked at this. He changed a lot over the course of his life. The Nation of Islam itself, as long as he was connected with Elijah Muhammad and the Nation, their attitude towards politics was stay away. That politics was looked at as part of the white man's tricknology was the phrase they used for that. But increasingly, Malcolm looked at it and he said, no, we have to get power. This is where power flows through. So Malcolm was actually, at the last year of his life, actively supporting attempts to take over office or to influence candidates at places where that was possible. One of the ongoing arguments is whether it was a good idea for African Americans to become fully associated with the Democratic Party, whether there wasn't a better argument to be made for staying a swing vote so that both parties had to give you something. Jackie Robinson was a Republican.
You mentioned the Black Arts Movement as sort of the cultural wing of the Black Power Movement, and we think of the poets that are writing. Isn't there a danger if you have a sort of political agenda that what you'll write is propaganda? And how did the poets sort of balance what they were trying to say with the desire to create art in and of itself?
Well, there were several approaches to that, one of which was simply to say that the aesthetic you just expressed is a very, very white aesthetic, that the separation between art and life, the idea that art is to remove one from life, that art isn't politics, that many writers, beginning with some very well-respected literary figures like Ralph Ellison, would simply say, no, that's silly, that all art is social, that if you think your art is apolitical, what that means is you are located in a position where you like the status quo.
But isn't that why Ralph Ellison objected to some of the black arts movement?
Oh, of course. Of course. That you can have bad writing, bad political writing or good political writing, and Lord knows there was a bunch of both at the time. Sure. That there was a opening for a lot of hustlers with black power. I mean, that's truth is light. That's what happened, is that it was easy to get a hearing on some of that stuff. Partly that was because a lot of white liberals, feeling guilty, just simply didn't know how to respond, so they'd accept anything whatsoever.
Couldn't distinguish the dross from the good stuff.
Sure. And partially it's just because the majority of Americans, black, white, Chinese, Latin, you name it, are not aficionados of fine poetry. And they simply
couldn't tell the difference.
But for all that, there was a very serious aesthetic argument going on here. And part of it came down to a question of whether the white critics who were in charge of the most powerful review outlets and whatnot got what was going on. When they thought about good writing, what they meant was what they had learned in graduate school studying Henry James or T.S. Eliot, whereas there were alternative aesthetics that were every bit as complex, every bit as deeply grounded in tradition. They were simply grounded in other traditions. So that Langston Hughes may look simple to you if you don't understand how African-American music operates. But if you do understand the nature of a jazz aesthetic or a blues aesthetic, then you'll make different conclusions. And so some of the very best poetry of the Black Arts Movement, Jane Cortez's poem on John Coltrane, many other poems on John Coltrane, was specifically about arguing aesthetic standards and saying, no, it's not that I'm bad, it's that I'm different.
Tell me about the good things, you clapping and laughing. Will you remember or will you forget? Forget about the good things like blues and jazz being black. Yeah, black music all about you. And the musicians who write and play about you. A black brother groaning, a black sister moaning, and beautiful, beautiful black children. Ragged, underfed, laughing, not knowing. Will you remember their names? Or do they have no names? No lives, only products to be used when you want to dance and cry? You taking, they giving, you living, they creating, starving, dying, trying to make a better tomorrow. Giving you and your children a history. But what do you care about history? Black history and John Coltrane.
What is the legacy of black power in the black arts movement? When we continue with University of the Air.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, call 800-747-7444.
Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band with Express Yourself, one of the expressions of the Black Arts Movement. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Craig Werner. We're talking about black power and the Black Arts Movement. Black power is already a phrase that has a kind of an antiquity to it. Is that because it was successful and blended into the power structure relatively smoothly, or is it because it somehow fell by the wayside?
The legacy of black power is extraordinarily complicated. In the terms it set out for itself, the terms of political change and revolution, it failed. What it got is it got a world in which more black people have a certain kind of power, which makes less difference to ordinary people in the community than anyone would have dreamed at the time. But in terms of style and in terms of art, it really did change the world. You can see it in, on one level, simply in the fact that there's great literature came out of the Black Power movement. The poetry of Audre Lorde, of June Jordan, of Etheridge Knight, there are a Henry Dumas, there are a bunch of poets, some of them well-known, some of them less well-known, who wrote poetry that stands up to anybody's standards. It tends to be buried in, now we're going to spend one day in a black literature class to look at the Black Arts Movement poetry. It deserves much deeper attention than that. Clearly, in academic terms, the single part of American literary history most in need of serious looks is the Black Arts Movement era. It's beginning to happen a little bit. Wonderful theater. The theater of Amiri Baraka, Dutchman, The Slave, The Toilet, particularly when he was grappling with his transition into black power. He wrote wonderful poetry. I think that Ed Bullins, who was Minister of Culture with the Black Panther Party in California, and a playwright, a brilliant theorist, talked about the way that black art needed to do two things. It needed to clarify the realities that people were living, and it needed to envision change. And he developed a theory of black dialectics that remains for me as profound a statement on political art as has ever been created. It's just been this year that Ed Bullins' plays have come back in to print. The Taking of Miss Janey and The Wine Time, Going to Buffalo, belong up there with Eugene O'Neill, Sam Shepard, at the very pinnacle of American drama. Interestingly, not much in the way of novels. The Black Arts Movement was very much concerned with immediacy of response from
what you get in the theater.
Audience.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you look at Toni Morrison's first novel, The Bluest Eye, which was published during the Black Arts Movement, it's about black beauty. It's about self-acceptance. It's about self-determination. And so every aspect of African-American literature since the Black Arts Movement works in response to the Black Arts Movement. It's been powerful as a presence in American multicultural literature. Leslie Marmon Silko, the American Indian novelist, Maxine Hong Kingston, Alfredo Vea, great Chicano novelist, all of them are coming into a world that was shaped by the refusal of the Black Arts Movement to separate the political and the social from the aesthetic. It's a both and, not an either or. And in music, it simply changed the world. That going into the Black Arts Movement, African American singers, musicians who wanted any kind of a white audience at all were forced to make songs that were white-friendly. Motown built its career on this. Sam Cooke early on built his career on this. Curtis Mayfield. Songs with nice hooks. Songs with wonderful harmonies and whatnot. And then James Brown and Aretha Franklin blew that wide open. They said, we're going to make music in a black way. Emphasis on rhythm. Emphasis on improvisation. Emphasis upon vocalization. Stretching the boundaries much more with your voice and your instruments. And they said, and white people are going to listen, or they're going to listen to white music, and nobody wants to listen to white music, they would say on that, and they simply changed the world. Hip-hop is an outgrowth of the Black Arts Movement.
Not to mention rap.
Rap, I mean, you name it, everything that you hear, rock and roll as it's grown up, as a large element of that assertiveness, that refusal to wear a mask anymore. We're going to say what we mean, like it or not.
For some of the figures who were older when the Black Arts Movement hit, who were already writing, like Gwendolyn Brooks in Chicago, when you see the Black Arts Movement affect them, how does their work change?
Yeah, it's one of the wonderful things about the Black Arts Movement is you see a cross-generational call and response, that you see the youth responding to the elders and the elders responding to the youth. Gwendolyn Brooks had grown up as a very, very conventional poet, writing in just intricate traditional forms. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Annie Allen, can be hard to read if you're not really into modernist poetry. She met during the mid-60s in Chicago, members of gangs. She met younger poets like Don Lee, Haki Madhubuti, who came to her and said, well, we like your stuff, but we think you're a little square, basically. And Gwendolyn Brooks thought about it for a while. She went to a writer's conference at Fisk University, and she said, the kids are right, that we need to be more assertive about who we are, that we can't be hung up on looking polite for the white people. And I think that Gwendolyn Brooks wrote some unbelievably powerful poem after that conversion. Her book In the Mecca, I think, is just a towering achievement in American poetry, not read as much as it should be, in part because it was associated with black power, black arts, and scared people off. James Baldwin, very similarly, had established himself as a writer in very conventional forms. A Faulknerian novel, Goatelled on the Mountain, was his breakthrough. I think that his last novel, Just Above My Head, published very much as response to the black arts movement, to the criticisms he was getting from some of the younger generation, I think it ranks with the top five novels written by anybody during the 20th century, and it is not understood that way. The battle to have black voices listened to. I think what Baldwin said is he took it a step deeper than even Langston Hughes in some ways. So I'm going into gospel. I'm going into the gospel tradition. Very, very few white folks know the gospel tradition. Now, black power was adversarial towards Christianity very often, but it opened the way for a much deeper sense of black Christianity as a part of both black music and black literature.
What were the international effects of black power and the black arts movement?
Well, probably the single biggest effect was a radical increase in the connection between Africa and African American life. It wasn't easy. It isn't easy. But there are a lot of tensions there, but there is an acknowledgement of acceptance. I think you see that most clearly, yet again, in the music, where James Brown toured West Africa in, I believe it was 1968, might have been 67. And if you listen to Nigerian popular music before James Brown tours Africa and after James Brown tours Africa, it changes. It sounds a whole lot more African. And people like Fela, the great Nigerian artist, was very uncomfortable with that, didn't want to have a situation where the descendants of slaves brought African culture home to itself. But in fact, that's what happened. But what James Brown was doing is he was simply tapping into the African roots of African-American music. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you see it in the visual arts all the time, that the use of African symbols, African ways of doing things, diasporic consciousness. So I think that internationally is one of the biggest effects. The other one is the spread of black liberation theology into the independence movements throughout the world, that particularly in Latin American and the Caribbean, James Cone's theology became central to the independence, autonomy movements, I guess is better. They were technically independent. So the creation of a sense that the world is interconnected in many, many ways.
There seems to be in this period just a really exciting overlap among the arts so that you could have a figure like Nina Simone, let's say, who is singing a blues poem by Langston Hughes but doing it at a political rally.
Yeah, and somebody like Nina Simone really brings that all together, that Nina Simone personally came out of the civil rights movement, as did Aretha Franklin, that many of the powerful figures were grounded in Martin Luther King's movement. But like Gwendolyn Brooks, they grew in to a new consciousness. They grew in to a sense of self-acceptance, that Nina Simone was as central a figure in black power soundtracks, what people played on the record players as they were running off their flyers and as they were plotting the revolution. But when you actually listen to Nina Simone, I think what you hear is you hear somebody who is saying this has always been with us. This is a part of what black people have always been. Her wonderful, wonderful song, signature song, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, says something that was particularly intense in the last half of the 1960s through the 1970s. People accepted it. They embraced it. But it was something that was always there in black life, that there had always been young, gifted, black people. What black power and what the black arts movement was really about was allowing those people to speak publicly, to speak openly, and to ultimately take off the mask.
And a nod back to Lorraine Hansberry.
Yeah. And Lorraine Hansberry, of course, the great dramatist, again, very much part of the civil rights movement, made the transition into black power, and her autobiography, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black.
Craig Werner, thanks for joining us for University of the Air. Let's go out on Nina Simone's To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
We can.